Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or tweet us at bookshowrte. We're also on Facebook, SoundCloud and iTunes, but we're here for the next 30 minutes. It's been a great week for Irish writers. Congratulations to Eimear McBride and Audrey McGee, who make the shortlist for the Bailey's Prize for Women's Fiction, and also to Donal Ryan and David Park, now nominated for the International Impact Dublin Literary Award. Later on tonight, you'll hear all about The Moth, an American organisation dedicated to storytelling in live form, on the radio, and now in book form. But first this evening, The Books That Define Ireland is a new publication which lists 30 books that have in some way defined us as a nation and determined who we are. The editors Tom Garvin and Brian Fanning join me now to discuss the books included. Brian, the books that are listed here have sparked debate and argument over the centuries, but where did the need for this list come from?
I guess it came first of all to amuse ourselves. Tom and I have talked over the years about many things, but mostly we find ourselves talking about books. We talk about the books produced by other people. We talk about the great books, perhaps, of Irish history and so on. And we just hit on this idea of putting together essays of books that we felt defined the condition of Ireland across the centuries. I mean, there is quite a lot of books written in the field of Irish studies that celebrate great Irish literature, novels, poetry, plays. And of course, these are vital to us. But we felt that there was something missing. We're both social scientists, and our angle and our take would be a bit different, to consider perhaps non-fiction books mostly that basically define the condition of Ireland, some of the great events that affected Ireland, the tone and timbre of Irish history as it goes through the centuries. And if we're looking at novels, we're looking at them more for their social impact or the debates that were sparked around them or the controversies around them.
Tom, I mean, when you think about starting to define yourselves as an Irish nation, can we track it back to a specific text or book or work?
Well, certainly we can trace it back to the early 17th century and perhaps earlier. I start off the collection with a long review of Geoffrey Keating's Furas Fasa Éireann, General History of Ireland, which is a kind of pseudo-history of Ireland, very, very nationalist, but very nationalist from a Catholic standpoint. He proposes in that work an alliance between the Sinn Gael, the old foreigners of Ireland, and the Aboriginal Gaels, all of whom have remained loyal to the Catholic faith. And he more or less suggests expulsion from the Irish nation of anyone who has not been loyal to the Catholic faith.
Well, we're talking in greater detail about the books that define Ireland, and one of the books I think a lot of people will have come across is Swift's A Modest Proposal. David Heap has performed lots of Swift pieces over the years, and he tells us about this satirical essay.
I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child well-nursed is, at a year old, a most delicious, nourishing and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked or boiled, and I make no doubt it will equally serve in a fricassee or a ragout. The situation of people in Ireland when he wrote Modest Proposal outside the pale of Dublin was absolutely atrocious. We all know, of course, about the famine of the mid-19th century, and vaguely know that there was one in the mid-18th century, but it was more or less an endemic condition during the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. It sets out in a classical satiric way of making an absolutely obscene proposal appear extremely reasonable given the circumstances, and then at the end, almost as a footnote, put in what really should be done to correct this appalling state of affairs. Therefore, let no man talk to me of other expedients, taxing our absentees, using nothing except what is of our own growth and manufacture, rejecting foreign luxury, introducing a vein of parsimony, prudence and temperance, learning to love our country, quitting our animosities and factions, teaching landlords to have at least one degree of mercy towards their tenants. Therefore, I repeat, let no man talk to me of these and the like expedients till he hath at least some glimpse of hope that there will ever be some hearty and sincere attempt to put them into practice. He wrote a lot of essays. This is one that I felt was really, really close to his heart. And I think that any piece of literature to be regarded on a list such as this should be one that is not only beautifully written, strongly argued, but deeply personal. And that's why I think it deserves to be on this list.
And thanks there to David Heap for telling us about A Modest Proposal. Tom, you include this in the books that define Ireland. And listening to that clip, it's hard to, you know, you can't miss the humour in it and that it's very funny. But when it was published, a lot of people didn't get that it was satirical and took it quite seriously.
Well, I put it on a course in America years ago, and several of the students took it seriously. They thought that Swift was actually recommending genocide and infanticide and everything else, and that he was a kind of proto-Nazi.
What's safe? But Jonathan Swift's great essay is that it comes at the end of a decade when he wrote an awful lot of serious essays about the condition of Ireland. So the internal logic of it is this: a man who writes very, very earnest essays about the condition of Ireland in the early 18th century is driven to writing a satire on his own earnestness as much as anything else. So this essay, taken alongside A Modest Proposal, taken alongside the other essays on currency, on the existence of trade barriers with England, with the very difficult position that the ascendancy in Ireland felt they were in vis-a-vis the greater sort of British project, his exasperation then about the inability of forces and people in Ireland to do anything about the condition of Ireland, that the whole thing was gridlocked and very badly run. So these things are, there's a huge exasperation there in Jonathan Swift. And that exasperation is perhaps a constant in our thinking about the Irish condition in one shape or form ever since. Exasperation about how we run ourselves, about how we govern ourselves and how we think about ourselves and our incapacity to sort our own problems out.
This election in the books that define Ireland really did shape the nation and were well known when they were published.
Well, the books we choose follow the main contours of Irish history. Geoffrey Keating is basically talking about a period when, before, if you will, Cromwell's time, before that conquest of Ireland that led to a period of Protestant domination of an ascendancy class. Swift is the great literary hero of the ascendancy in many respects. And others we include then later, like Wolfe Tone, are people who challenge that ascendancy from a Republican perspective, or people who challenge it from a nationalist perspective later on, such as John Mitchell or James Connolly, who challenges from a socialist perspective. So whether we're talking about the ascendancy era and how they viewed themselves, or about 19th century nationalism and how some of the great writers of that time saw those debates unfolding, or we're talking about the dilemmas of the 20th century, which include, of course, in our most recent, if you will, parts of the book, the great books on political corruption, on child abuse, and so on, of the last number of decades. So a lot of our books are kind of capturing those dilemmas as they move across time. And the dilemmas shift. I think most readers would have a sense of what those dilemmas are and how they have shifted. What these books do is that they give perhaps unique voice to those conversations as they unfolded, and perhaps draw people into the detail of these things and perhaps how people felt about these issues at that time. So I think people will read books about our time to get an insight as to how we were, how we lived our lives, how we engage with our problems, be it the crisis of the moment, be it political corruption, be it clerical abuse, be it other problems we've experienced in recent decades.
Brian, it's interesting that you mentioned that the bulk of the book is non-fiction, but I'm delighted to see that you included fiction on the list and one short story collection that not only gives a great insight, I think, into the Civil War, but also just a great short story. Derek Hand of St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra explores the short story Guests of the Nation with a reading here by Eamon Hunt.
The plot of Guests of the Nation is quite simple. It revolves around two characters, the Guests of the Nation, who are prisoners of the Irish army, and they're being held to eventually be executed.
The enemy have prisoners belonging to us, and now they're talking of shooting them, he said. If they shoot our prisoners, we'll shoot theirs. Shoot Belcher and Hawkins, I said. What else do you think we were keeping them for, he said. Wasn't it very unforeseen of you not to warn Noble and myself of that in the beginning? I said. How was it? He said. You might have known that much.
The hope is, of course, from the narrator, that this won't come to pass. But it's a small house. They play cards every night. They get to know the prisoners. Belcher particularly has a great sort of fondness for the woman of the house, the ladies in house they're sort of staying, and helps her with the little domestic tasks and so on. So it's a very sort of quiet, subdued scene. But the tension then builds when it becomes known what's going to sort of happen.
"We have had enough of this," said Jeremiah Donovan, cocking his revolver. "Is there any message you want to send?" "No, there isn't." "Do you want to say your prayers?" Hawkins came out with a cold-blooded remark that even shocked me and turned on Noble again. "Listen to me, Noble," he said. "You and me are chums. You can't come over to my side, so I'll come over to your side. That show you I mean what I say? Give me a rifle and I'll go along with you and the other lads." Nobody answered him. We knew there was no way out.
It's written in the 30s, so it's 10 years after the War of Independence. And I think the fact that it sort of returns to that moment and forces its readers to look at that again, I think, is interesting for the time and continues to be so. I think it humanizes that event in the sense that it tells a very human story. It also raises the question in a post-independent Ireland and a post sort of war Ireland, that question of the divided loyalties between the demands of nation ideology and the desire to be individual and human. So in a very clear, coherent, powerful way, it raises perhaps sort of submerged questions around that kind of conflict.
Thanks there to Derek Hand and also to Eamon Hunt for the reading of Guests of the Nation by Frank O'Connor. Brian, it's a brilliant short story. Listening to that, there's no question that you had to include this, surely.
Absolutely. I mean, Frank O'Connor is one of the great short story writers of the world and of the 20th century. And in the 20th century, the short story is the great Irish literary form. But Frank is also a very, very important Irish intellectual, absolutely embedded in the intellectual conflicts of his time that include his great colleague Sean O'Fualon at one side espousing a version of liberal nationalism, and against that, cultural nationalists who were attracted to a very isolationist version of what Ireland might be after independence, like Daniel Corkery. So in a sense, there's a huge political undertone to Guests of a Nation and to a lot of the non-fiction work that Frank also does.
Brian, in terms of narrowing down the fiction, I mean, there's a wealth of things you could have put in here, but you very specifically chose John McGahern's The Dark and The Country Girls by Edna O'Brien. Why them?
We wrapped them up in one essay because they're both books set in the 1940s and they appear later. And Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls, as well as being a great novel, sparked a debate about censorship. And it's a remarkably different novel than perhaps many of the other Irish novels, whereby people feel very oppressed by Catholicism and feel they can't do very much about it. Whereas Edna's character just breaks free. She's a free spirit in a sense that perhaps many Irish protagonists of great stories and short stories like, say, James Joyce's characters are not. McGahern's The Dark appears in 65, a few years after The Country Girls, and again sparks controversy. It's his second novel and it is banned. And it becomes, if you will, the great cause célèbre of banned books, the last one really. But it was O'Brien, Edna, who basically broke that dam to begin with and created a situation where writers like McGahern felt it was ridiculous that their work should be banned, and he wouldn't have expected that really. And these writers perhaps in the 60s managed to redefine what one can write about, think about and say. But all they were really doing were talking about things people were doing and talking about anyway. In McGahern's case, it's a very dark story, The Dark. It's about child abuse. It's in a rural setting. Edna O'Brien's story is about a young woman essentially being able to realise her potential by leaving the community and moving to the city. And sexuality is discussed very frankly in both these books. And I think we see more happening in these novels than we see in the reports and journalism of that time. So those books are really social documents, and they bring to life things that are happening perhaps in the dark, in secret, in the country. But do so in a way that absolutely transforms how we can talk about things in Ireland.
On the issue of child abuse and the idea of a work being a social document, Suffer Little Children is mentioned in the book. It was written by Mary Raftery and Ona Sullivan, who talks here about the publication of the book and the mood of the time.
The origins of the book Suffer Little Children partly came from a three-part television documentary shown on RTE in around Easter time 1999. Which explored for the first time the full history of industrial and reformatory schools in Ireland. And I think what made it unusual at the time was that we had, myself and my co-author, the late Mary Raftery, had access to the Department of Education files. The Department of Education had administrative responsibility for industrial and reformatory schools in Ireland for most of the 20th century, and we were the first two researchers that had access to those. The book allowed us to explore in much greater detail the archives of the Department of Education. And it became very clear as we got access to the archives and started working our way through them that the state had a very considerable role both in inspecting and funding and regulating the schools, but it exercised that role in a very cursory manner. And it was the kind of the indifference of the state bureaucracy and how timid they were in dealing with many of the religious congregations, I suppose, really jumped out at us. That there was a level of debate, a level of discussion and debate around the book that really wasn't focused on the substance of the book, but rather was about bigger issues around the role of church and state, and that defenders of the church came out and saw the book as an attack on that rather than what we saw it was a detailed critique of the role of the state in managing these institutions, rather than an attack on the Catholic Church. So I think all sorts of other agendas came into play in the discussion around the book. I think the book was an important catalyst in generating the debate that's been going on ever since, and particularly with the publication of the Ryan Report in 2009.
And that was Ona Sullivan there discussing Suffer Little Children. Tom, it was a very angry book, and I remember the response to the accompanying documentary, and he mentions there that it was a catalyst of sorts. It did throw light on a very dark aspect of Irish life, didn't it?
Well, it's a dark thing, all right, and it's one that goes back a very long way, and over which there was an enormous silence for a very long time, for over 100 years. Well, you must remember that the relationship between church and state in Ireland was devised by the British government, partly in response to the French Revolution, a very long time ago. And that relationship has been, if you like, traditional, and is only really being attacked or criticised or being analysed properly in the last 20 years or so. Before that, you weren't really free to do these things, and we had to use foreigners, if you like, visiting firemen, they were sometimes called, to feel free to criticise church-state relationships in Ireland. The classic one being Blanchard's The Irish and Catholic Power, which is one of the books that we deal with in our collection, and which became a sensation when it came out in 1954. In fact, there were attempts to ban it, even though there was nothing illegal in what the man wrote.
In terms of a book like this, the books that define Ireland, which we're talking about tonight, what books do you think people expect to be in there that aren't in there?
Perhaps James Joyce's Ulysses is one that perhaps people would talk about because it is the greatest Irish novel, without doubt. But it's a book that took a long time to find a readership and did not influence social debates in Ireland, even if it was masterful in how it described and captured the life in the day of Dublin through its fictitious protagonist Leopold Bloom. Novels like Cannon Sheehan's were much more the stuff of the ordinary imagination and were closer perhaps to the immediate debates that shaped the country at the time. I mean, we've only had room for a couple of novels in there because they sparked great social debate. The chain of books that we end our collection on are all ones that look at crisis in one shape or form, from Nell McCafferty's A Woman to Blame, the Kerry Babies case, to Fintan O'Toole's Meanwhile Back at the Ranch, the politics of Irish beef in the 90s, and of course the Rafferty and O'Sullivan book Suffer the Little Children, and a very recent edition, just published a year or two ago, Elaine Byrne's Political Corruption in Ireland, which is the first academic book ever on political corruption, if you can't believe that. So these are the things perhaps that are capturing where we're at now. And whilst novels like Ulysses were very important for stimulating debate about Irish identity, if Ulysses has shaped Ireland at all, it's perhaps through the creation of Bloomsday, a tourist event.
Tom, do you fear people coming up to you about omissions and talking about books that aren't in here, should have been in here?
In fact, I've already had people suggesting to me that I do another collection of important books for a change. But really, we're looking at books that are historically important, rather than books that are perhaps artistically great, although some of them indeed are, like Guess the Nation itself, which had a historical impact at the time. It made people look at the Irish Civil War rather differently than they had earlier. They were able to look on the young men who fought in the IRA as people who were trapped as much as anything else, and trapped by their own convictions and by their own organisation. And this is also true of Cannon Sheehan. Sheehan was read by everybody, and he put the case for De Valera's Ireland more eloquently than De Valera ever put it. And he did it a generation before De Valera.
Well, I think there's a lot of books in here that will spark debate, and a lot of books that people probably haven't got to and have meant to over the years. My thanks to Brian Fanning and Tom Garvin. Their book, The Books That Define Ireland, is published by Irish Academic Press. Now, we were interested in what other books you think define Ireland and sent Liam Geraghty out onto the street to find out.
Any book, the history of Ireland, and as you know, years ago you might have taught it in school and that, so you only learn your own history over the years from reading, especially on the net now as well, like, so you can. But I mean, if it's a book about Ireland, that's all I'll read it.
Angela's Ashes, I know it's fairly iconic and everybody talks about it, but it's definitely a good one.
Well, I think there's a book written between 1840 and 1861 by Henry Mayhew called The Poor and the Labour of London. And in it, he interviews a lot of street life of London. And one story in particular, I think, sums up Ireland in a way, is the story of a guy who left Limerick, sold up everything, walked to Dublin, got the wrong ferry, ended up in Newcastle and walked to London for a better life. And it just shows the resilience and the determination that's there within the Irish people, I think.
Voices of Connemara is a good book that I read a while ago. It tells the story of different people in Connemara. It's a good social history. Yeah, it's a good book.
I suppose one idea for a book that represents Ireland is Your Passport. It's something that you make yourself. It's presented by the state, but a lot of people really hold on to their passports even after they cut the ears off them. It's got our harp on it. It's got your own face on it and your own signature.
And thanks to Liam Geraghty for bringing us your views. Let us know on Twitter which books you think define Ireland at Bookshow RTE. Now, The Moth is an organisation in New York dedicated to the art and craft of storytelling. They've just published their first book, which is a collection of stories that have been told live by people like Malcolm Gladwell and Adam Gopnik. Sounds Alive Productions invited The Moth to Ireland to the Freemasons Hall, and Zoe Cummins went along to find out more.
In Ireland, we have the reputation of being good storytellers, but we're getting a run for our money from The Moth.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a retired pickpocket. I see a lot of you reaching for your wallets right now. But I did say retire because if it wasn't, you'd be too late anyway.
This is the Moth Radio Hour.
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 I've got competing nightmares.
This is the Moth Radio Hour.
I'm being stabbed. I'm in a car crash. I'm in surgery. I just flew through the windshield.
The Moth is true stories.
Hold live, no scripts, no second takes.
But be careful because my gun is in there and I don't know if the safety's on.
They're like old-fashioned front porch stories.
Sarah Jennings is the producing director.
The Moth is a nonprofit storytelling organization, now National Public Radio show, and we showcase true personal stories told by everyday individuals. So it's really the humor and pathos and ordinary lives of everyday people.
Ordinary people, perhaps, but with extraordinary stories. And not always showing their best side.
Mistakes are what make us human.
Catherine Burns is artistic director and edited the Moth Collection.
We would transcribe the live tapes and then lightly edit the stories. So hopefully you hear the people's voices.
Astronaut Michael Massimino's story is in the Moth Anthology.
If he were to just brag about going up to space and what a hero he is and how cool he is, I mean, that would be cool to hear.
But his blunders make for much better storytelling.
My favorite moment of his story is he discovers, like, millions of dollars have been spent to send him up to space.
Massimino was on a final repair mission to the Hubble Space Telescope.
And he's there, and he's trying to fix this space telescope. And when he goes to open the back compartment...
And there were two screws on the top, and they came off easily. And there was one screw on the bottom right, and that came out easily. And the fourth screw is not moving. And my tool is moving, but the screw is not. And I look close, and I realize it's stripped. And I realize that that handrail's not coming off, which means I can't get to the access panel with these 117 screws that I've been worrying about for 5 years. Which means I can't get to the power supply that failed, which means we're not going to be able to fix this instrument today. Which means all these smart scientists can't find life on other planets. And I'm to blame for this.
The most successful storytellers are the ones who are willing to be, to really show their humanity and to kind of tell on themselves. Because I think that people like hearing about other people's struggles, whether or not it turns out okay. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
At the Dublin event for The Moth, Manchan McGann takes to the stage. He tells a story about running an Ecuadorian hostel 20 years ago.
Sometimes you spend your whole life doing penance for a sin that you don't even know you've done, or at least I do.
Whilst he was there, war broke out between Peru and Ecuador.
This beautiful place, it was an eco-hostel on an organic farm in the foothills of the Andes.
Right. Within a few weeks, things started to get out of hand.
And so, one day, the army colonel of the Ecuadorian army turned up at the hostel and he said, "So what are you going to do for the war?" And I told him, "Don't worry, me and the hostel, we're going to keep our heads down. We're sure that the army is going to protect us valiantly and all will be well." And he said, "No, you don't understand. What are you going to contribute to the war effort?" And I told him, "No, I'm a pacifist. I was educated in Dublin, actually. I don't do war." And he said, "No." He looked around him and he said, "This hostel would make an ideal barracks for my men." And I said, "No, I have international backpackers here. We have a mango papaya farm. We have a lovely spa at the back." And he said, "Okay, I want $3,000 by tonight. I want a quarter of your staff as recruits in the army, and I want that." He looked behind him. It was a swimming pool. I said, "You want the swimming pool?" He said, "I want that swimming pool emptied, dried out, and a camouflage created for it so that I can store missiles in it." Now,
well, to us, that live is what makes The Moth The Moth, because the audience really becomes a part of the story. Their reaction, the stories aren't memorized. I mean, of course, people work on them very carefully in advance. Like, we actually, our directors and producers work with them one-on-one. But it's not, they aren't memorized. It's more like they decide a basic arc and they decide the beats.
Truth is stranger than fiction, it's true. And we think that it's quite interesting to mine your own experience and to be able to share those feelings and that point of view with a room full of strangers. There's something terrifying in that. There's like a tightrope that you're walking.
Because it is so basic, because it is so simple, because it's something we've all been doing forever. I mean, it's not like The Moth invented storytelling, but you know what we are doing that is maybe a little different is like cocktail party stories, dinner party stories, and putting them on stage in front of a live audience.
Thanks to Zoe Cummins for those interviews, and the live audio from the Freemasons Hall was produced by Julian Clancy from Sounds Alive Productions. To hear more about The Moth's visit to Ireland, log on to soundsoutloud.com, or to read The Moth stories in print form or listen to the audio versions, go to themoth.org. The book show was produced by Zoe Cummins, but you can listen back on SoundCloud, iTunes, or at rte.ie. Next week, we'll be bringing you a show from Galway, where we go to visit the Kirch Festival and talk to local and international writers. But before we go this evening, earlier in the programme, we talked about the books that define Ireland and mentioned Ulysses. We'll leave you now with Regan Hutchins and a footnote, which gives a sense of how Bloomsday was first celebrated in Dublin.
If you frowned on Arthur's Day antics, shield your eyes from the very first Bloomsday celebrating James Joyce's Ulysses. It was in 1954, the 50th anniversary of Leopold Bloom's original Dublin walkabout. Horse-drawn cabs were arranged for, among others, Patrick Kavanagh, Anthony Cronin, and a very drunk Flann O'Brien. The plan was to follow the novel's progress about Dublin city. But having started at the Martello Tower in Sandycove, where heavy-booted Kavanagh almost kicked O'Brien in the face as he climbed the steps, the day descended from there into a pub crawl. By the time they reached Sandymount Strand, they had to relieve themselves, just as Stephen Dedalus does in the novel. They abandoned the rest of the pilgrimage, settling instead for the Bailey Pub on Duke Street. And so began a typical Irish tradition. Bloomsday, I mean.
The book show was presented by Sinead Gleeson.